Hello and welcome to Fantastic Fights, the podcast about a middle-aged man playing adventure game books out loud on the internet. That middle-aged man is me, Hieronymus J. Doom, and this episode we're playing Mage Hunter by Paul Mason with art by the legendary Russ Nicholson. This is book 57 in the Fighting Fantasy series, and the end of the original run is very much in sight. Cover art for Mage Hunter is a typically Baroque piece by Ian Miller, which shows a giant bird and a dragon locked in aerial combat. The bird is carrying a man in one talon who is either trying to cast a spell or throwing shapes on the dance floor, I can't quite tell. It's a glorious riot of yellow, green and red, and I like it very much, but then I'm a sucker for Miller's style, which always seems to me to evoke the strangeness of fantasy worlds particularly well. The font they've chosen for the title is a bit disappointing though, it's just big and yellow and not particularly interesting. Mage Hunter is one of the most expensive of the classic fighting fantasy books to get hold of, it's a real collector's item. I am therefore indebted to a mysterious benefactor who has enabled me to play this book in a fashion slightly better than the low quality scans doing the rounds of the internet. Mysterious benefactor, thank you very much indeed. If you'd like to be a not-at-all mysterious benefactor of this podcast, don't forget that you can support me over at patreon.com/HJDoom and score yourself some gaming goodies in the process, including my brand new game book, Mutiny Most Merited, which is about pirates and that. Now let's take a look at the rules of Mage Hunter. There's not much formal rule stuff to get through. We're mostly in classic fighting fantasy territory here, with skill, stamina and luck all present and correct, along with 5 provisions and 1d6 silver pieces. Being a mage hunter, we get some unique items to start off the adventure, and these are a great way of setting the tone of the story. Unlike most fantasy books, we get a firearm, a pistol, with black powder and 3 bullets, one of which is silver. We also get a basket-hilted sword, a lovely detail, and our clothing is specified as being undyed cloth and leather, as this apparently reduces the effectiveness of magic. As a mage hunter, we've also got no less than 12 mirrors for use against mages, and a rope of human hair which apparently binds mages effectively. Lastly, we get a compass needle, which is always a handy bit of kit. What these bits and bobs do very effectively is clue us into the setting and the tone of the story. It is simultaneously telling us that the setting is more technologically advanced than the usual fighting fantasy book, but at the same time, even more superstitious. I've said before that your starting kit can do a surprising amount of heavy lifting for setting the scene. Something as simple as telling us we've got a basket-hilted sword instead of the classic longsword immediately helps paint a surprisingly specific picture in my mind's eye. I'm guessing I've got some kind of broad-brimmed hat as well, for example. This is brilliantly reinforced by the other unique element in the rules text, which is a series of instructions for hunting dastardly mages. And I'm going to read that in its entirety because it is a work of genius. The most revered treatise of mage hunting. In the course of my long career as a pursuer of foulness and castigator of demons, I have found the following methods to be effective. 2 or more in combination should be sufficient to constrain even the most potent magery. Defeating a mage. 1. Dressing a sorcerer in undyed cloth will tie him to earth. 2. A bullet of purest silver will pierce a mage's skin. 3. A sword which has been touched by the mage's blood may wound him. 4. Tying a wizard with a rope of human hair will restrain him and prevent him from using sorcery. 5. A mage cannot protect himself against his own sorcery. Detecting a mage. 1. Wizards do not eat fish. 2. Mages must always wear some red cloth close to their body, or they will be deprived of half their power. 3. Small birds will sicken and die if a sorcerer is near. 4. If asked from whence they came, mages never tell the truth. 5. If submerged in water, a sorcerer's body will swell to twice its normal size. Pursuing a mage. 1. If the holy symbol is drawn in the earth and a stone cast into the circle, It will fall in the quarter showing the direction of the nearest mage. 2. If a compass needle is dipped in wizard's blood, it will always show the direction of the wizard, and the speed at which it moves shows how near it is. 3. Every 101st footprint left by a mage is that of a cat. 4. A hound that is fed for a week on nothing but goat's meat may sniff out the scent of a wizard. 5. The flames of a fire lit in the open air on the 13th day of the new moon will point in the direction of the nearest wizard. Have a care, for wizards are impervious to normal earthly weapons and may use their powers of trickery to deceive a pursuer, no matter how stout of heart. Any man who accepts the gift of a cloak from a wizard will be in that wizard's power. Use your wits, and may good prevail. So I think that is tremendous, and what it does is manage to condense kind of the entirety of Heinrich Kramer's Malleus Maleficarum into a single page of text. It's playing around with the folklore around practitioners of black magic in the real world, and also the practitioners of magic in role-playing games. In role-playing games, magic generally functions as a form of esoteric technology with deterministic rules governing how spells are cast and how their effects resolve. These rules usually serve to make magic predictable and replicable. The same spell will tend to have the same effects each time it is cast. What magic doesn't typically have in role-playing games are folkloric structures of obligation and restriction. Wizards in games are rarely bound by unusual codes of behaviour or subject to unusual compulsions or vulnerabilities. And when the player brings this knowledge of how wizards typically function in fantasy games to the text I've just read, it raises the distinct possibility that all of these rules about hunting mages might actually be nonsense. It's completely possible to write a book where magic does function in a more folkloric way, but all of the reader's experience will tend to suggest that this supposed guide to hunting mages might be no more accurate than Kramer's Malleus Maleficarum, even if they've never actually read that tome. It's a really clever thing, and honestly, I'll be equally happy if it turns out wizards are genuinely banned from eating fish, or if the whole thing just turns out to be superstitious nonsense. So, I have rolled up a character who I have decided to call Blister Ribblesnatch, which should strike fear into the hearts of wizards everywhere. Blister has a skill of 10, a pitiful stamina of 16, and a luck of 10. They have 4 silver pieces to their name, and they're all ready for adventure. So let's play Mage Hunter. Background. The chase nears its end. Your quarry is desperate. You hope that no more innocents will be sacrificed in his attempts to escape justice. Your lungs are bursting, but you run along the earth track as fast as you can, praying that in the gloomy twilight you will not be tripped by a stray root. Then, silhouetted in the gate of the cemetery, you see your enemy, Mencius. He leans on one of the pillars for support, his cloak flapping in the night breeze like a giant black carrion bird. His head turns, and he sees you, and an unearthly screech rends the air. He casts around like a cornered fox, but you have fenced him in with your circle of mirrors. He has nowhere to go but the cemetery in which the body of his mother lies. Here, his sorcerous power is crippled, and he knows it. He flaps his arms in a last attempt to fly and manages to rise a meter off the ground before a silver bullet from your pistol brings him crashing to earth. So, I think I said in the last episode that there's nothing better than being thrown right into the middle of the action, and this is doing a tremendous job of doing exactly that. I'm very excited already. Panting hard, you cover the last 50 meters to where Mencius sprawls. He raises a contemptuous face to you. "I curse you to the end of eternity," he snarls, "and I will have my revenge." You have heard many such threats before, and you're still alive, so you waste no time in replying, but bind him quickly with your rope made of human hair. If you can return him to the Margrave's castle before dawn, he can be destroyed on the morrow." Already playing with the idea that maybe being a mage hunter is perhaps not the most morally upstanding profession in some ways. There's a cruelty and callousness to what we're doing that very much dehumanizes the object of our hunt, and that's interesting as well. "Fate is not with you, however. On the return journey, your horse stumbles, and Mencius, bound and slung across the saddle, cackles malevolently. Surely his magic could not have caused the upset, but you are unnerved nevertheless. Your horse is lame, and you have to lead it the rest of the way. When you arrive at the castle, it is nearly midday, and worse tidings await you. Mechna, the old Margrave, who sponsored your cause and lent his considerable power to the hunt for wizards, died in the night. Your arrival is hardly noticed amid the funeral preparations, and you cannot be sure that your urgent instructions to the guards leading Mencius down to the dungeons will be followed properly. As a bondsman of the Margrave, you must attend his successor, the feckless youth Reinhard, at the funeral rites. After your success in bringing Mencius to justice, it promises to be a dispiriting day." So that is the background. It's nice and brief. It covers a lot of ground. It set the scene brilliantly. I'm really impressed. "The funeral is held immediately. By tradition, the heir of the deceased wears red mourning clothes, while everyone else must wear undyed cloth. This is no hardship for you, as you always dress in undyed cloth and rough leather. You take your place in the funeral cortege and slowly follow the coffin on its journey to the castle chapel. The rites last for several hours, and the company then returns to the great hall, where a last meal will be eaten to the honour of the dead Margrave. After the second course, young Reinhardt, clad in ceremonial scarlet, makes his excuses and leave. You wish that you too could leave this dismal feast, but courtesy forbids it." And there is a picture of the dismal feast, which we can see various people sat around looking performatively sad in a castle hall and eating food. It's very good. The style of dress, I would say, is kind of high to late Tudor, or early modern, perhaps. Yeah, it's a solid piece of work from Ross Nicholson. Perhaps not his very finest work, but perfectly serviceable illustration. "Suddenly, the castle starts to shake. There are screams, and you leap to your feet, swaying as the floor heaves beneath your feet. A block of masonry crashes down, and mourners dive under the stout oak table for protection. Are you willing to risk a breach of etiquette and head for the dungeons, or stay where you are?" I am more than willing to breach etiquette on this occasion. I feel as though if the castle's falling down, whether or not you're passing port in the right direction becomes a little bit of a moot point, so we will head for the dungeons. You rush along the cold stone corridor, dodging falling stones. The vibrations intensify as you run, and a crack appears in the floor in front of you. You teeter on the brink, then leap across. Half jumping, half falling, you descend the stairs to the dungeons. A wisp of green smoke is seeping from the furthest cell, and you can hear a voice raised in some occult incantation. The ground shakes beneath your feet, but you sprint to the cell door and crane your head to see within. Mencius stands with arms raised, his shackles lying at his feet, and the rope of human hair dangling uselessly from his arms. Reinhard stands staring to one side. He is transfixed, with the key to the shackles still in his hand. A guard cowers in the corner of the cell. Green smoke is seeping from the ground. Mencius starts to spin, and with a deafening crack, the ground splits open. The spinning sorcerer and the transfixed Reinhardt move slowly towards the yawning abyss. There is a picture of Reinhardt and Mencius. It's really good.
Mencius is in his robes, looking old and sinister.
And a lovely idiot Margrave standing, looking appropriately, vacantly aristocratic as Mencius plies his magic. Yeah, it's a cracking bit of work. Now, do you want to prepare your pistol to shoot Mencius or rush him to try and disrupt the spell? I feel as though there's probably not time to prepare my pistol. It's a time-consuming business, I assume. I mean, I assume this is some kind of match lock or wheel lock rather than something quick to load and deploy. So I will rush at Mencius to try and disrupt the spell. You make a dive for Mencius, but the crack in the floor widens and an unearthly force sucks you towards it. You hover on the brink as Mencius plunges down. Then Reinhardt desperately grabs for you. You both fall headlong into the blackness. Seconds pass and lengthen into minutes. Time no longer seems to be passing. All around is black. Feeling disappears from your limbs, then from your body. The sensation of falling is gone. So I feel as though that could have gone better. Light bursts upon your eyes like a shaft of ice. You are standing on a mountain ledge. Out of the corner of your eye, you see a figure toppling from the ledge. You rush to the edge, but are too late. The figure falls down the scree slope and plunges into a fast-flowing river. You watch for some seconds, but see no sign of him surfacing. A groan from behind brings you spinning round. Mencius is lying in a heap on the ground. His jet-black hair is now streaked with grey, and a trickle of blood dampens his brow. If you waste no time in killing him, that's an option. If you examine him while he's unconscious or bring him round, those are options as well. I feel as though, as a mage hunter, the thing to do is to kill him, but I also sort of feel as though I'm not going to be able to get back home without some help, or at least some information from this sorcerer. So I'm going to examine him while he's unconscious to begin with. There is something very unusual about Mencius. Not only is his hair streaked with grey, but also his skin has aged. Apart from the wound in his head, blood is also flowing from the bullet wound in his belly. Although the silver bullet pierced his skin, you know that his sorcerous power must have drawn the edges of the wound together. It seems that Mencius has no power left, for how else could the wound have reopened? You untie the rope of human hair, keeping it handy in case the maid shows any signs of regaining his magic. Now, what to do about the wound? Do you want to staunch it, or remove the silver bullet first? I will remove the silver bullet first. Those things cost a pretty penny. Examining the wound, you can see the dull gleam of the silver bullet lodged in Mencius's gut. Without proper tools, you'll just have to use your fingers. As you probe into the cavity, Mencius's body jerks and spasms in unconscious pain. As quickly as you can, you get a grip on the bullet with your thumb and finger and ease it out. Gory, but kind of appealing as an image. Pocketing the blood-stained silver bullet, note it down on your equipment list, you rip up Mencius's robe to make a wad of cloth. It's a crude way to bandage a wound, but tied in place, it seems to work. Mencius soon comes round and stares up at you, bleary-eyed. "What sorcery is this?" he demands. "You look exactly like me." His eyes contain none of the infernal malice you are used to, only bewilderment. The truth hits you like a charging bison. Mencius has switched bodies. The poor wretch before you is really Reinhardt, whose body you now inhabit. You tell him what has happened, and he begs you to set things right. So, kind of a good job I did not murder the wizard when I had the chance. I wonder who's got the best out of this deal. I mean, I've got a nice young body. I don't know how old Blister Ribble Snatch is, but yeah, I guess, it's bad news for Reinhardt, who's got an old man's body. Erase the following items from your adventure sheet. Pistol, 3 bullets, box of powder, broadsword, undyed clothes, mirrors, compass needle, and silver pieces. Erase all of your provisions.
The good news is that we have some equipment to replace it.
In addition to anything you acquired since passing through the magic portal, so I have a silver bullet, you now have the following: a rapier, fine red clothes, jewellery, rope of human hair, 10 gold pieces. Lose 3 points from your skill and 6 points from your stamina until you are specifically told that this is restored. Wow. That's exciting. That's a great twist. So I now have a skill of 8 and a stamina of 10. This is a problem. So do you want to try and find a way to switch bodies with Reinhardt? No, not really. I mean, this body might be rubbish, but it doesn't have a sucking gut wound. So I think instead we will prepare to move. This is such a great little rug pull. You have no idea where you are. You left the Margrave's castle in late autumn, but now the heat of the sun shining from a clear sky is almost unbearable. The terrain here is unfamiliar. You don't even recognise the tree and shrubs. How do you propose to track Mencius? So we can follow the river downstream. We can light a fire, we can draw a holy symbol, or we can climb to the mountain top. Well, I suggest we will draw the holy symbol. Let's see whether this superstition actually has some foundation. You start to draw the holy symbol in the sandy soil of the hillside using Reinhardt's fancy rapier. When it is finished, you pick up a smooth stone and offer up a prayer. For this method to work, you must be completely calm. But a slight dizziness overcomes you. Your scalp prickles. Your eyes are locked with Reinhardt's. Do you want to break eye contact and carry on with the ritual, or continue staring? I think I might continue staring and see what happens. I worry that somehow Mencius is able to look through his own eyes and keep track of me. There is the strangest sensation of falling upwards as you keep on staring deep into Reinhardt's eyes. Your quick wits realise what is happening. The spell which switched your bodies is reversible. You now know how to switch bodies. Whenever your scalp prickles, you can change bodies with Reinhardt or Mencius. You will not be given this as an option, but you may choose to switch anyway. To switch, add together the digits of the paragraph you are at, then add the results to the paragraph you are at. For instance, you are now at paragraph 149, which I am. You wish to switch bodies, add the digits 149 to 14. Add this to the total of the current paragraph and then turn to that paragraph. If, on the other hand, you wish to break eye contact and prevent the transfer, you can do that as well. That is complicated. That's very complicated, but genuinely cool. It's a clever bit of design, actually. I feel as though just adding 20 to the paragraph would be easier, but maybe there's some advantage to variable movements within the text. I'll have to think about that and maybe return to it as a thing in my closing remarks. For now, let's switch bodies and see what happens. A sharp pain in your stomach jolts you awake from the dizzy hypnosis. Reinhardt lets out a cry of triumph at being back in his own body. In the box marked companion on your adventure sheet, write 5 next to your skill and 8 next to your stamina. This is so complicated already. Then tick the boxed mark switch in the bottom right hand corner. This box shows that you are now in your companion's body. So we'll mark that with an asterisk on my homemade character sheet. Write any equipment you gain while in this body in the bottom part of the equipment list so that you can keep track of who has what. Now that he has his body back and you are stuck inside the feeble shell of Mencius, Reinhardt is keen to continue the divination. Composing yourself once more, you toss the stone into the circle. It strikes the exact centre, then bounces in an unexpected direction. A strong reading. Tracing a line from the centre through the stone, you work out the direction you will have to travel by making for a distant cluster of rocks high up on the mountainside. Despite the punishing glare of the sun, the two of you make good time, discovering a mountain path which leads roughly in the right direction. I really am impressed by just how bonkers the design of this is. It sort of appears on the surface as being like a very classic old school fighting fantasy book, and then immediately just veers off into sheer lunacy, and I am absolutely here for it. The path finally passes through a sheltered valley, its cool air a welcome relief from the blistering sun. At the far end, a plume of smoke emerges from a hole in the rock. Below it, a dark opening suggests a cave. You approach the cave mouth warily, peering into the inky blackness. You can't be sure, but a faint sound seems to be coming from the cave, possibly a human voice. Abruptly, it stops. You move into the opening, trying to determine whether it really was a faint glimmer of light you saw. Sure enough, a dancing light appears, easily recognizable as a torch. Preparing yourself for action, you wait expectantly. The torchbearer turns out to be an old man, dark of skin, with a cloth wrapped around his head. He jabbers at you, then stands puzzled when you respond by asking him who he is. After a while, he holds up his hand for you to wait and trots back into the darkness, returning a few moments later with a book. Setting the torch into a wall sconce, he flips over the pages of the book. When he finds the place he needs, he starts to mutter and gestures with his free hand. He is a sorcerer, casting some kind of spell. Do you want to attack immediately or wait and see what happens? Well, I think he's probably going to try and cast some sort of language spell so he can talk to us. So I think we will wait and see what happens. Also, given that I'm currently in the body of an old man with a sucking gut wound, I don't think throwing hands is going to be an especially sensible plan. Your eyelids start to feel heavy, and your head presses on your neck like a lead ball. You are falling asleep. Do you wish to resist the spell? If so, roll 3 dice and try and get under your stamina. So I'm going to allow him to hypnotise me, because, yeah, it just doesn't seem like with a stamina of 8 I'm going to do a particularly good job of resisting it anyway. So the chase nears its end. Your lungs are bursting. Mencius turns his head and sees you. A silver bullet from your pistol brings him crashing down. I curse you to the end of eternity, to the end of eternity, to the end of eternity, to the end. You wake up to find yourself lying in a comfortable bed, staring into brown eyes. Forgive me for hypnotizing you, says the owner. It was necessary in order to cast the spell which places our language in your mind. You start to reply, then realize the implications of what he has said. Note down the word Cal on your character sheet. If you already have basic Cal, remove the word basic. He continues, I have also learned something about your mission. The foe you pursued through the dimensional portal into our land, the Chaos Mage Mencius, is a great danger. His power is such that I can sense his presence in this land, and day by day he is growing stronger. This is a most confusing development. This man is clearly a sorcerer, yet he is like no other you have ever met. In your years as a mage hunter, you have found you can almost feel the malice exuded by a mage. Could it be that there are some wizards who are not evil? Surely not, since magic is a gift of the evil one. And yet... So we seem to be in a completely different dimension as well. God, there's a lot going on in this story. So, intriguing and stuff. Well, I'm impressed that Mencius has now turned into your classic fighting fantasy big bad guy. So that's almost comforting in a way. And by the way, says your unusual host, my name is Kashim the Unworthy. Anything that is within my power to help you in your mission, I will do. Do you have a shackle key? I do not. Do you have a Shauker scar? I do not. Yes, Reinhardt pipes up. There's something you must do for me. Is the box marked switch on your adventure sheet ticked? It is. Catch the treacherous rogue who brought me here. I want him flayed alive, you hear me? Flayed alive! Reinhardt has lost little of his arrogance, it seems. He appears to have learned no humility, despite the fact that it was his foolishness which caused this mess in the first place. Luckily, Kashim seems more concerned with your wound. Brushing aside Reinhardt's blustering, he takes a tiny jar of powder out of a small pouch, recites a short chant and places his hand on your stomach. A wave of well-being comes over you. For the first time since you switched bodies with Reinhardt, the pain from your bullet wound completely disappears. In the companion box of your adventure sheet, erase any current entries for stamina and skill, and enter the value skill 6, stamina 12. So, we're a very slightly more hench old man at this point. I can help you in several ways, says Kashim. First, I can give you some protection from his magic. He hands you an amulet with a chain to go round your neck. I don't guarantee that it'll protect you completely, but it should help against a direct attack. Secondly, I can advise you to be careful, because our world is so rich in magic, Mencius's power is growing daily. He will no doubt already have gained some knowledge of Calamere. Finally, he says, unfurling a short, luridly patterned carpet, I can get you to Calamere quickly and secretly. We can fly in 30 minutes. Do you have any of the following on your adventure sheet? Vizier's robe, owl backbucks, glass, or Kurt? I have none of those. I have missed some massive chunk of adventure somehow. Kashim's comment about flying remains a mystery for a while, but he does point out that Mencius has been in Calamere for a few hours at most, so you will arrive hard on the villain's heels. Note down early on your adventure sheet. After you have rested a while longer, Kashim picks up the carpet and escorts you out of the cave into the valley. Do you have a shackles key? I do not. Reinhardt complains when Kashim lays the carpet on the ground and tells him to get on it. It's true that you too feel a little foolish, but if you don't trust Kashim a little, you won't be able to get anywhere. Finally, you are all on the carpet, sitting down. With barely a jolt, the carpet floats up into the air. Reinhardt lets out a shriek of fear, but without giving him a chance to speak, Kashim says, To Calamere! And you shoot off with the speed of a diving falcon, the air buffeting your face and making your scalp prickle. So, scalp prickling means that we can, in fact, swap bodies again, and I'm going to do that very thing, because Reinhardt's body has slightly better stats than mine at the moment. You check on Reinhardt, staring deep into fear-stricken eyes. For a moment you think you have fallen off the carpet, but then you remember the unpleasant sensation of the body switch. Is the switch box on your adventure sheet ticked? It is. Erase the tick from the switch box on your adventure sheet. Reinhardt is furious at having been tricked into switching back into Mencius's body, and he leaps at you. Beware! You'll upset the carpet! Cries Kashim, but his call is unheeded. Do you have Kurt with you? I do not.
Looks like we're gonna throw down with Reinhardt on a magic carpet.
There is a diagram showing the flying carpet, which is a sort of oblong, strangely enough, with 12 squares on it, so it's a sort of a 4x3 grid, and in the middle row on the right-hand side, Kashim, Reinhardt and I each occupy a single square. So we fight. Whoever loses an attack round will be forced back, and we see which direction they will be forced in. Oh, it's complicated. So there is a picture, before we get into the complicated rules, of myself and Reinhardt, who is confusingly in a different body, tussling on the flying carpet. Oh, it's a cracking bit of work. Yeah, it's got that sort of slightly grotesque quality that Russ Nicholson brings to a lot of his work. It's really nice. The Reinhardt figure, very much looking absolutely demented. I love it. So, yeah, we fight as normal. Then the loser gets pushed back either in a straight line on a 2-5 or on the diagonals on a 1-6. If either of us enters the square containing Kashim, the whole carpet will shake. Okay, so Reinhardt has skill of 6 and a stamina of 12. I have a skill of 8, but only a stamina of 10. So I'm going to do this live because it's sufficiently bizarre that I feel as though it'll give you a sort of flavour of what's going on with this. So, first round. So Reinhardt rolls 6, giving him a total of 12. I roll a 9, giving me a total of 17. So Reinhardt now reduced to 10 stamina, and he is pushed back. So on a 1 or a 6, he's pushed back on the diagonal. On a 2 to 5, he's going to be pushed back into Kashim. So I roll a 2. That pushes him back into Kashim. That means that we now have to roll a test of skill for myself and for Reinhardt. So for myself, my skill is 8. I get a 7. I'm fine. Reinhardt gets a 7, which is more than his skill of 6, which means that he has fallen off the carpet. This is unfortunate, not least because he's wearing the magical amulet, I've suddenly realised. Reinhardt is gone. Surely no one could survive a fall from that height. Note down the word missing on your adventure sheet. This is so complicated. Also, erase any items Reinhardt was carrying. I am sorry about the death of your countrymen, says Kashim, but we must nevertheless dispose of Mencius. Since you are not using weapons, you recover 2 points of stamina for every 3 you lost in the fight. Well, I didn't lose any stamina, happily. So I remain on 10 stamina. The journey lasts but a few minutes. Thanks to the carpet beneath you and the clouds which surround you, you see nothing of the country over which you are travelling. Finally, you spiral downwards, landing gently on a flat roof in a large city. I covered our approach with a charm of invisibility. But if I remain here for any length of time, Mencius may detect me and flee, says Kashim. So I will wish you the luck of Hazar and depart. So saying, he floats up into the air once more. The carpet dwindles in the distance at an unbelievable speed. You rest a moment to steady your legs, then descend by some stone steps to the busy street. The city comprises a dazzling variety of buildings, most of which are unlike anything you have ever seen. The people show a similar variety. Although hair and skin tend to be dark-coloured, there are people here of all heights and sizes, rich and poor, and gentle and fierce-looking. There are even some strange creatures that don't seem to be human at all. All this variety does not make your task any easier. There is a picture of the city, all manner of towers and minarets. And it's pretty cool because there is a sort of, I guess you'd say, a very gently Islamic influence on the architecture, but it's subtle and more sort of fantastical. Similarly, the people, again, they have that, what would be, I guess, to most Western readers, an exotic flavour to them, but without necessarily cleaving to one particular culture. So, yeah, it's a nice, characterful bit of work from Russ Nicholson. Do you have a ruby ring? I do not. Do you have a scar? I do not. Do you have the word abandoned written down? I do not. So, I am doing incredibly well at this adventure. If you have 3 crosses marked on your adventure sheet and do not have the word home written there, cross off the word early if you have it. If you have the word fame underlined on the adventure sheet, turn to another section. If you have the word fame but it is not underlined, underline it now. If you have 5 or more crosses on your adventure sheet, write down the word fame if it is not already there. This is demented. So we've got choices. We can approach the authorities. You must have the word Cal. That's fine, I do. Make inquiries and hunt for clues. Look for a storyteller. Again, you need to have Cal, basic Cal. Use mage hunting methods or go to the market. I'm not going to the market. I'm sick of markets. So I will make inquiries and hunt for clues, I think. Choosing your subjects with care, you make discreet inquiries concerning recent newcomers to the city. You learn about all sorts of strange arrivals, but one in particular seems to match Mencius's current appearance. His clothing is described as outlandish, and his hair colour also fits. Going by the name of Saba, he has established himself rapidly in the city by means of his regular performances of magic in the bazaar, an area of the city made up of tents and frequented by lower-class merchants. If you continue to make inquiries, you can turn to one section. If you have the word early written on your adventure sheet, which I do, you can turn to a different section. So, yeah, let's do that. Further inquiry reveals that Saba is not the only foreigner matching Mencius's current description to have arrived recently in Calamere. A street urchin tells you about a strange-looking person who somehow managed to obtain an audience with the city's ruler, Isaiah al-Buda, shortly after this person was granted permission to live in the Rangor Tower overlooking the market, a building which has stayed empty since the death of the city's previous ruler. Mark a cross on your adventure sheet. So, one cross. So you can go straight to Rangor Tower. You can go to the bazaar to check on Saba. Let's go and check on Saba first. Let's go and have a look at Rangor Tower first. The Rangor Tower overlooking the marketplace. That is where your pursuit of Mencius leads. You can see why he would want to make it his lair. As it is built on the very edge of the cliff, it is impossible to fence the mage in with a circle of mirrors. As you stare up at the tower, it seems to exude a quality of permanence, as if it is somehow more than real. You mount its steps and cautiously push open the brass-studded door. The great hall inside is empty. You walk warily across towards the staircase in the opposite wall, surprised to see that the opulent carpet is covered with tiny bones. You have walked no more than 6 paces when the trap is sprung. The door slams shut and a horde of living skeletons wielding bright bronze scimitars arise from the tiny bones. Do you have the Book of Craft? I do not. If you have the ring and know its secret, you may use it unless you have the word genie written down, in which case nothing happens. Do you have Kurt with you? I do not. Wow. I thought I was bad for keywords. And I am. I love a keyword. I really love a keyword when I'm writing books, but this is absolutely insane. I'm enjoying the adventure. I am enjoying the adventure. But there is a lot of functional text to have to wade through to get to the immersive stuff. Anyway, the skeletons press in on you relentlessly, blades whirring. You manage to hack down a couple of them, but the end is inevitable. From the chamber above, a mocking laugh echoes down to you. It is your enemy celebrating the defeat of his greatest foe. Now his evil will spread unchallenged. Your story ends here. So, a little bit too soon to be ending the adventure, so we will return to the centre of town and choose a different option. Sausagey Finger bookmark rule has been invoked. It feels as though there's lots that I have missed. So let's go to the market. Calamere's marketplace is full of aggressive traders desperate to foist their wares off on you. You can find anything you want, but obtaining it quickly is another matter. You start to grow a little suspicious of the quality of some of the wares on sale. You can also try to obtain money by selling any precious object you may have acquired. However, soon you realise you are not going to get the best price here. You are looking for a quick sale and haggling with masters of their craft. Note that 10 silver pieces are worth 1 gold piece. So, we can buy all manner of things. There's a picture of the market as well. It looks very much like a bazaar, as you would expect. Lots of tents. You can see the walls of the city and various people bustling to and fro, looking for a bargain, trying to hawk their wares. Yeah, it's another classic bit of Russ Nicholson work. So we can buy candles, a backpack, some clothing, a fine cloak, a dagger, some gloves, a horse, a lantern, a mirror, some provisions, some rope or a sword. And they vary in price from 1 silver piece to 40 gold pieces for the horse. We can sell a horse, a ruby ring, a gold hex, a shouker claw, a vizier's robe, Owl Backbuck's glass. Crystal goblet, a diamond, jewellery per piece. I think I've got like one bit of jewellery, so I could make some money from that. That would be a good plan. In fact, let's do that. We get 10 to 60 gold pieces. So I get 20 gold pieces, giving us a total kitty of 30. Magic amulet, a serrated knife, and a lapis lazuli brooch. If you have a dog and wish to obtain goat meat, you can. If you possess a ruby ring and you know its secret, you may use it. So, am I going to buy any of this stuff? I don't think I am, to be honest. I've got no idea which of these items will prove useful. Yeah. I mean, I guess I could get some more mirrors. No, I'm going to leave it. So, we need to mark another cross on the adventure sheet. Now at 2. And we go back and choose another option. So we will go and approach the authorities. You soon discover that the current ruler of Calamair is Azaya al-Budur. Her palace lies in the middle of the city near an imposing statue of a woman carrying a sword in each hand. If you apply for an audience with Azaya al-Budur to warn her of the menace of Mencius, mark a cross on your adventure sheet, then turn to one section if you have the word Bath on your adventure sheet, or another one if you don't. If you simply wish to make inquiries, that's one option, which varies if you've got the word early or if you haven't. I will try and make an appointment, I think, and I do not have the word Bath. To obtain an audience, you require a vizier's robe, otherwise you have to bribe the various functionaries at the palace. Tactful inquiries reveal that this will require either 15 gold pieces or any of the following: a diamond, a piece of jewellery, a crystal goblet, a ruby ring, or a lapis lazuli brooch. If you know the secret of the ring and you still possess it, you may use that. So we will bribe with 15 gold. The audience is for one person only, so if you have a companion or Kurt, they must wait for you outside the palace. You are led into a magnificent audience chamber in which Azaya al-Budur sits regally on a throne, attended by huge men with oiled muscles and sour expressions. She peers at you short-sightedly. You prostrate yourself before her, then, rising to your knees, tell her all about the peril of Mencius. She listens to your story, then pauses for long seconds before declaring, "What babble is this? Why should I fear some wizard? I have 6 of my own to protect me." She waves her hand imperiously. That went well. A huge attendant closes in from either side and grabs you by the arm. You can offer no resistance, or you must fight the courtiers who have a skill of 6 and a stamina of 8, and a skill of 5 and a stamina of 7. I probably could beat them both, fighting them at the same time, but I really don't feel as though murdering 2 of her courtiers is going to be a particularly sensible plan, so I will offer no resistance. The courtiers drag you along a number of corridors and down flights of stairs, finally depositing you in a tiny, lightless cell. Here you languish for several days, wondering whether you will ever see sunlight again. Finally, guards drag you from your cell and throw you out of the palace gate. If you have the word early on your adventure sheet, cross it off. Do have the word early, we can cross that off. If you left a human companion outside the palace, there is now no sign of him. Note down the word missing on your adventure sheet. However, if you left Kurt here, he runs up to you, apparently none the worse for a few days alone in the city. Do you have one or more crosses on your adventure sheet? I do. So we're back to the centre. Now we have 3 crosses on adventure sheet, so we would have to cross the word early off unless we had the word home written there as well. God, it's so complicated. I guess the only thing left is to try the storyteller. You should only seek out a storyteller you have not met before. We have Al-Fakik, Al-Hadar, and Al-Nashar. I guess we'll go for Al-Fakik. You mention the name of Al-Fakik to several passers-by, and having obtained directions from an old woman, you finally arrive at a ramshackle hut in the docks region. This is hardly the safest district you have visited, nor does Al-Fakik's dwelling inspire much confidence. There is no door, so you push aside the drape in the entrance and peer in. Your eyes take a while to accustom themselves to the darkness. When they do, you find your gaze returned by someone with a fat face and hair sticking out at improbable angles.
What do you want, then?
A peremptory voice demands. So there is a picture of Alpha Geek. He looks, pretty down at heel, pretty portly. And he does have weird sticky out hair. Another typically fun and evocative Russ Nicholson bit of art. We can tell Al Fakik his brother sent us, which isn't true. We can tell him about our search or ask for a story. Let's tell him about the search.
So?
Asks Al Fakik.
What do you want me to do about it?
You didn't expect such rudeness from the fellow. Do you ask for a story? Tell him that his brother sent you, or have you got the word trail on your adventure sheet? I haven't. I never have. I never have anything written on my adventure sheet. I guess we'll ask him for a story. Alpha Keek spits on the rough floor.
It'll cost you, he says. 2 gold in advance.
Sure, why not?
My story is a warning to mind one's own business and trust in Hazar. Those who meddle in the affairs of the powerful will suffer a terrible fate.
Know then that in the time of the former ruler of Calimair, the Caliph Carolina, the country was beset by a terrible disaster. A wicked sorcerer from another world, Bythos by name, conspired with Siege to Silence on the Grand Council to conquer the whole land and overthrow Hazar's sacred ruler. While the army guarded the northern borders against a threat of invasion from Bihan, Bythos's army of country folk, whose souls he held in thrall, swept towards the city from the east. Who could halt their advance? Brave Ramides, hero of Calimair, was the only possible saviour, but he was away on one of his many voyages of adventure. Just when all hope seemed to have fled, however, he returned and... Alpha Keek's head falls forward onto his chest. Moments later, a rasping snore emerges. You prod him awake and he leaps up with a start.
Be off with you, you rascal! He shouts. Think you can steal my money, eh?
He snatches up a knife and brandishes it in front of your face. If you want to make a hasty exit, there's 2 options. One if you've got the word trail on your adventure sheet, and 1 if you don't. Otherwise, your only option is to fight him. Do you know what? I'm going to fight him. Fed up of these people. Everyone in this city is so unfriendly. So he's got a skill of 5 and a stamina of 5. I'm going to roll some dice. I have defeated Alpha Keek and I suffered no damage. You can recover your 2 gold pieces. Apart from these, Alpha Keek has nothing of value in his hut. Nothing that you can find, at any rate. Do you have the word trail on your adventure sheet? I do not. So gold back up to 15. And we mark another cross. We go back to the centre of town. So we're now up to 4 crosses. Let's try the old mage hunting methods. This is a teeming city in a strange land. Who knows how many mages infest it? Since you don't have any of Mencius's blood, you have little choice of methods. Do you have Kurt with you? I do not. It's time to draw the old holy symbol and chuck a stone at it. You scratch the holy symbol on the dusty ground, drawing a curious crowd of street urchins. You toss the stone, then sight along the direction indicated. It leads to the rear of an ornate building of white stone with delicately fluted columns. You slip in through a rear entrance, finding yourself in the precincts of a huge bathhouse. Portly, naked bathers lounge around in steaming water. You have no way of knowing which, if any, is a mage. Before you can proceed any further, the bathhouse's bouncers, 2 fat bald men in absurd silk bloomers, block your way. First bouncer has a skill of 5 and a stamina of 8. Second has a skill of 6 and a stamina of 7. We fight them 1 at a time. I'm going to roll some dice. I have defeated the 2 bouncers. They reduced me to 6 stamina. So I now have 5 crosses on my adventure sheet. And I get to write the word fame on my adventure sheet. And honestly, I think this is probably as good a point as any to pause. I've been through most of the options on the town hub and kind of got absolutely nowhere, and it feels as though I am petering to something of a halt. So on that note, I will pause the recording. This is a really interesting book. I am sort of enjoying it in the sense that I like the ideas that are being deployed. I very much enjoy the bait and switch of being moved to a completely different setting. The stuff with body swapping is really fun and really different. The only thing so far is the fact that the rules text really does get in the way of me becoming fully absorbed in the story. It does to an extent feel as though I'm fighting against the book rather than just reading it and enjoying it. But part of that might be down to the fact that I'm reading out loud as well, which is a slightly different experience. I mean, it's a very different experience, actually, to just reading the book.
Stuff that works really well spoken out loud
is often a lot more basic than the stuff that works perfectly well when I'm reading on my own time. Simple, clear stuff is just much more fun to read out loud. So anyway, I'm going to go away. I'm going to play through Mage Hunter on my own time. I'll be back for you in just a few seconds with some closing remarks. Tatty bye. It feels like that playthrough went out with more of a whimper than a bang. I didn't actually carry on with that playthrough, but had I done so, I would have died very soon anyway, thanks to running out of time to find Mencius in Kelimar. Mage Hunter is something of an odd one. It's highly experimental, mostly successfully, but the sheer amount of mechanical density makes for a curiously abbreviated feeling adventure. Overall, though, I've really enjoyed playing it, and it feels like one of those destined to stick in my memory, which by 57 books into the series is no mean feat. In terms of structure, there is a lot going on. That's more or less going to be the recurring motif in this review. There's just a lot going on all of the time. Now, your successful playthrough will tend to be quite short, rocking up in a strange new world, stopping off at a local town for a quick drink before taking the magic carpet to Kelimar and doing a fairly minimal amount of detective work before giving Mencius a good drubbing in his lair. His lair isn't even a mini dungeon, which I'm honestly quite grateful for. You've got to find a way past his skeleton bouncers, the ones that did for me on the recorded playthrough, but once you've done that, you'll be straight into the final showdown. In terms of the number of paragraphs you get to see, this might be one of the shortest successful paths in the series. However, that doesn't mean that there isn't plenty to do in Mage Hunter. Thanks to an incredibly dense design, there's loads of different ways for things to pan out, although there is only one correct path to absolute victory. And it is quite tricky to winkle out as well. In my playthrough, we got embroiled in a bit of body swapping, but if you take a different and much worse path, you can actually rock up to the quest in your own body, which makes a lot of things pan out very differently. Some things are much easier, other things become harder, and you can't actually finish the adventure. It's eerily like being trapped in my own body in real life. Every encounter in Mage Hunter feels like it's constantly spiralling off into a myriad of possible outcomes, which is both extremely immersive and also somehow simultaneously a barrier to immersion. On the one hand, it's great to see all the different ways things can go. There's so much pleasure to be had from finding all the different outcomes, especially for the encounters that are a decent distance from the main path. On the other hand, there's a lot of rules text that has to go into making all the different encounters work. You're constantly being asked whether you have this item or that keyword, and aside from occasionally making it feel like the book is playing itself based on a decision you made several weeks ago, it also just eats into the word count. When every paragraph is loaded with different conditions, there's much less space for the evocative prose that makes a gamebook feel truly absorbing. This is definitely as dense as you can get without it feeling like you're doing admin more than being on an adventure. And it's a testament to how much I enjoyed the world and the adventure that it didn't get in the way more. This is a book that feels like it would benefit hugely from an electronic version which could quietly handle all of the bookkeeping for you and only present you with the options that you can actually choose from rather than a laundry list of things that could happen provided you previously visited the sock peddler on a Wednesday and it was also raining. I think this complexity probably hits its apogee in section 241, which one of my correspondents before this episode was recorded did point out to me as being a particularly over-the-top example of the complexity. And it's the introduction to Kelemar, and I think we should remind ourselves as the contents of section 241, just to see how ludicrous this gets. It begins. If you have three crosses marked on your adventure sheet and do not have the word home written there, cross off the word early, if you have it, and turn to 194. If you have the word fame underlined on the sheet, turn to 383. If you have the word fame but it is not underlined, underline it now. If you have five or more crosses on your adventure sheet, write down the word fame if it is not there already. Otherwise, you should choose from one of the following options. As you can hear, it's not particularly smooth and it does take you out of the action quite a bit. I think I also managed to get some elements of the various bits of recording wrong on my recorded playthrough, but honestly, that's fairly typical. As soon as I was done with my recorded playthrough, it is the area that I was thinking there has to be an easier way of doing this. And once I delved into the book more deeply, I could see what the author was doing. It's a time mechanic, but he wanted to have the option to jump to the end if you really screwed up, which is why the time is partly counted with X's and partly counted with the keywords. And I think if you wanted to do it in a simpler way, then a fame score would have been the approach I'd have taken. And I wouldn't have messed around with the additional keywords and underlining things at all. It would have just been a fame score where there is a single threshold that triggers the bad thing happening. And then if you want to just instantly trigger the bad thing happening, you can just like add 5 points to the fame score. And that means that the opening would then read, if your fame score is X or higher, turn to paragraph Y immediately. It would mean adding an additional section to the rules portion of the game book to cover how fame works, but you could also do that in an introductory bit of text if you wanted to, just before you hit the main hub of Kelemar, and that would keep the fame system as a little bit of a surprise. It is just ridiculously overcomplicated, but it does work as intended, and that's one of the other striking things about this book. In terms of keyword manipulation, it's as complicated as you are ever going to want to get. I don't think there's anything more you could realistically do within 400 sections without the whole plot grinding to a halt. We've seen a lot of books break down at points due to complexity, most infamously in Creature of Havoc, which broke down on a system significantly less complicated than Mage Hunter. Mage Hunter just works. Given that it's got all of these various keywords and items and the fame system and not one but two systems that rely on adding numbers to the paragraph you're on to reveal hidden paragraphs, and some of the sections that hinge on a score of different keywords, each relating to a slightly different version of events, this is quite a remarkable accomplishment. And I salute Paul Mason for turning in a book that operates entirely as he intended. It's impressive at this level of intricacy, and especially with the kind of turnarounds that the Fighting Fantasy series had. I don't get why the two secret exit systems have you adding up the digits from the section you're on, and then either adding or subtracting them from the number of the section you're on, rather than just adding or subtracting a nice round number like 10. Like, if you want to do that, why not just say, if you read the words, your scalp prickles, that clues you in that you can body swap and just add 10 to the paragraph that you're on. That feels like complexity for the sake of it. And there is a lot here that I think could be reasonably easily streamlined, but I will take clunky and functional quite happily, and it is functional. A more substantive criticism is that there's so much going on here that certain elements of the plot don't get the room they really need. The whole body swap thing is an ingenious idea, And given that the successful path involves Mencius being in your body, it creates a situation where rolling a rubbish character is actually a benefit in the final showdown, since you will be in Mencius's body and fighting Mencius, who's in your body, and rolling a low skill will make that body a much easier fight than if you rolled high. It's even complicated to explain. That is a wonderful twist, and it's fascinating to see a fighting fantasy book where rolling a bad character is actually a benefit. Okay, there's occasions in some of the books where you might want a low luck because there's something locked behind a failed luck test, but managing to invert the usual high skill, high stamina starting character is wonderful. I like also that you can do portions of the book in your own body without it falling apart as well. That's cool. What doesn't work so well, for my money, is the companion mechanic where you can have Reinhardt along in one body or another. NPC companions are notoriously hard to do in game books, and the author's made things very difficult for himself by deciding that he's going to write the book in such a way that you may or may not have Reinhardt along for the ride. I started off with him in my playthrough, but then pushed him off a magic carpet, which was quite cool. Who among us hasn't wanted to push a spoiled brat off a magic carpet? The problem with the companion being only potentially present for the entire book's run is that he has to fade into the background for long stretches, and that makes it easy to forget that he's actually there. And a character that annoying shouldn't really be fading into the background, he should be constantly present. This is an issue with the format as much as the author, but the most successful companions in fighting fantasy have tended to be the ones who are confined to a small area where they can be that constant presence. Reinhardt is great when you get to interact with him, but there's too many points where he's invisible. I think there's space in 400 sections for either a really satisfying body swap story, or a story where you have to squire around some horrible little rich boy, but probably not both. I'd love to have seen the ability to swap bodies even more explored, with different bodies having different stats and keywords associated with them, and potentially having sort of different backstories that could get you into various scrapes when people mistake you for the person that you've jumped into. That would have been awesome, kind of quantum leap sort of vibe. Equally, I'd have enjoyed trying to keep a moronic posho alive while he tries to make out he's the one in charge. That would have been fun as well, in a very different way. As it is, both elements feel a little shortchanged, though the body swap works well enough. There is a sense of panic to being trapped in a middle-aged body, as I know all too well. I didn't play this one as a child, so I can't tell you whether that sense of panic is worse or better for the intervening 35 years, but honestly, as a 40-something man, being turned into a 40-something man in a game book feels cruel and unusual. So there are issues with this game book, but I don't really think they get in the way of having a nice time with it. Though it could have been a bit less complicated, the fact that everything works goes a long way, and while I think more of a focus on a few core elements would have made for a more satisfying narrative, everything that's included is still basically fun, and there's a great deal of joy to be found within Mage Hunter once you make your peace with the admin. The opening twist, where you wind up in a completely different world, is marvellous because it's not telegraphed at all. The authors put a lot of effort into the rules section, making it completely committed to selling you on this world of evil wizards and superstition, and so turning up somewhere different is a genuine surprise, provided you haven't thought too much about the guy with the turban on the cover. The whole thing with the weird rules about mages turns out to work in your world, or at least some of them do, and you can import the more helpful and less abstract of them into Titan as well. I'm full of admiration for the way in which Paul Mason has managed to make the world you come from feel completely different to the classic fighting fantasy world through obtuse rules around mages and a few allusions to slightly more modern technology. It's a brilliant example of how to do successful world building in a tiny space. One advantage of the complexity is that this book is jam-packed with little weird elements that will only trigger under very specific circumstances. There's a lot of bits of the adventure that are tricky to find, which makes coming across them feel genuinely special. If you make much better decisions than me, you can come across an apparently friendly stranger called Al Backbook, who will buy you a few drinks and teach you the rudiments of the local language. You get the option to give him a gift as a thank you, and how nice and useful he is as an NPC depends very much on the quality of the gift you give. Fail to give him a gift at all, and he'll take umbrage without telling you and send you to a complete wrong'un in Kelamar in the hopes of getting you killed, and I love that kind of detail. If you give him the best gift, he will be a firm friend and set you on the correct path to victory. There's also a fun little underground lair that's quite hard to get to, alongside a chance to go to the beach and almost get eaten by crabs. There's a genie ring you can find, which seems like a good bit of kit, and indeed it mostly is. But if you make the wrong wish and use it to try and find an NPC who turns out to be dead, the genie will take an appropriately sadistic delight in fulfilling the letter of your wish by trying to murder you so that you can go and find the dead man in the afterlife. That's a lovely evocation of the classic idea that genies are not entirely to be trusted, and you do need to be careful when presented with wishes. There's plenty of points where you can make good use of the genie as well, though, and that is nice. All of this genie stuff is on the wrong track, where you're in your own body, and I very much enjoy how generous it is with bespoke elements that only apply on the failure route, because it gives you that incentive to go back and explore that part of the book, even knowing that it wasn't going to end well. I feel like I would have enjoyed having a good ending on that track as well, but there is only so much you can fit into 400 sections. There's already some nice variability with how things finish up. The best ending has you and Reinhardt in your own bodies back home, with the young Margrave having learned some kind of valuable lesson about life. However, it is possible to accidentally come home with Reinhardt in the body of Mencius, which ends about as well as rocking up to a tense family gathering in the body of Piers Morgan. There's a wonderful nested narrative too along the way, a story within the story, where in order to get a necessary item, you have to listen to a storyteller, and the story is so evocative that you become part of it, and you have to do some fights and make some decisions about how the story ends. The fights are perhaps a touch too challenging, given that they're required, and if you're on the right track, you're stuck in the body of a middle-aged wizard, but it's a very neat way of getting a storyteller into the book while still preserving a sense of interactivity. These fights stick out because, in general, the fights are fairly sensibly pitched at the right level for the right body. There's not a huge number of them, and very few of them are on the correct path, which is a thing I always really appreciate, given how often we've seen fighting fantasy authors, when stuck for a plot point, just have an orc turn up. There's a tiny number of genuinely challenging fights, but if you find one of them, that means you done screwed the pooch, and at least one of them is clearly intended to kill you stone dead. And it's always nice to see a truly brutal fight used as a form of death, not least because it gives you a way to cheat past it. I also appreciate the way it uses the core fighting fantasy system in a way that pans out to really incentivize you not to use force. It feels very different to be in a situation where my natural instinct was to avoid fights at all costs. One last thing I think the gamebook does well is make Mencius present as a threat. The fact that he's in the opening and you can find out what he's been up to as you explore, as well as potentially meeting him briefly along the way, makes him feel much less remote as a villain. He's a threat, and the opening does a great job of making every mage feel like a threat, but the stakes are considerably more personal thanks to him messing with you personally. And I'm always a fan of making stuff personal, especially when that personal enmity is based on something as odd as stuffing you in the wrong body and transporting you to another dimension. It's fresh, it's exciting, it really makes me want to get even with him. And the detective portion of the game, where you're sort of trying to find out where he's gone and what he's been up to, that also makes him feel very present in the narrative as well. So altogether, he is one of the better villains in the Fighting Fantasy series. A quick note on the art to finish. There's some classic Ross Nicholson action going on here, and his character work, as always, is strong, but I don't think this is his finest work in the series. There is a lot of good stuff, to be sure, but some of it feels a bit by the numbers, and I think he only comes alive when there's either something really characterful or something really grotesque to get his artistic teeth into. Some of the monsters are fantastic, but there's some of the NPCs and some of the more standard monsters, they just don't feel especially memorable. It just goes to show that even the greats need a little inspiration sometimes. Overall, I really enjoyed Mage Hunter, and it's one that I enjoyed more the more I played of it. It's nice to see this level of ambition on display this late in the day, and I'm beyond impressed at how well the whole thing hangs together. It's ambitious, clever, and novel to the point that it almost becomes a problem, but there is a core narrative there which I found compelling and which kept everything moving along nicely. It's a real shame this one has never been reprinted, because I think it deserves to be more widely read. Partly because it's a lot of fun, and partly because it shows just where the boundaries are in a certain kind of gamebook design. You can go this far, but no further, I would tentatively suggest, at least not without writing something considerably longer. Well, that is all for this episode. I hope you'll join me in a couple of weeks when I'll be playing something. Not sure what yet, but I've got a stack of unread gamebooks to draw upon, so I'm sure I'll find one that tickles my fancy. In the meantime, you can email me at hjdoomretrofun, or one word, at gmail.com, or follow me on Blue Sky at hjdoom. This podcast is now available on YouTube when I remember to update the feed. Thank you very much for listening. Take care, and I'll see you soon.